Hello, I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter. Tonight, we're going to talk about an inevitable life event, and that specifically is death. Many people say they do not fear death, but rather they're anxious about the process of dying, including possible pain and incapacitation. So we might wonder, what is a good death? What would you want for your own dying process for the last weeks or months of your life? Medical advances may prolong a person's life, but not necessarily enhance the quality of the life the person has remaining. Prolonging life at any cost can produce unnecessary suffering both for the dying person and for their family. Tonight, we'll also explore what we can do to better manage our own end-of-life process. And I have invited Vance Sanders this evening to the show. Vance is a former board member of Juno's Foundation for End-of-Life Care and a much-respected Juno attorney who's focused on healthcare law, estate planning, disability, and the elderly. So, welcome to Mind Over Matter.
Thank you very much.
And you have been, I saw a little tidbit, you have been practicing law in Juneau since 1984?
Correct.
Is that when you moved here?
Yes, summer of 1984.
Now, I know you are a North Carolina native that doesn't have a very strong accent. Did that just happen because you have been in Alaska so long?
I'm married to a speech-language pathologist. So,
yes.
So, of course, she's tried to sterilize my twang, so to speak.
There's a hint of it.
Just a bit.
Just a bit. Now, I know that you're going back and forth between
right.
North Carolina and Juneau these days. So do people think you're a northerner when you're in North Carolina?
It's interesting. I've been gone for so long from there. I left in 1977 to go to school and then have lived in, Chapel Hill, North Carolina for 7 years and then here for going on 31.
Yeah.
So it's really changed a lot, the place, my hometown where I grew up. And we went back to principally help care for our parents.
Yeah.
Both my dad and stepmom and my wife, my mother-in-law, are still alive, and they're in declining health. And it was, they wouldn't come to Alaska, so that was really important to us to go back there. And so it's one of those situations where the people I grew up with, a lot of them have left and aren't there now. And it's a really different... It's a different existence. I'll just put it that way.
Uh-huh.
But a good one.
A good one. And so you're right in the thick of elderly parents.
Yes.
And so you know personally of what we will speak of tonight.
Indeed, I do.
And though it's some time off before you have to face your own inevitable demise, I know that you work in this field.
Right.
And so, like me, I have led the bereavement group at hospice and also have had parents die. I think about it a lot. But I want to know how you first became interested in end-of-life issues.
I started out when I first came to Juneau with Alaska Legal Services and got to go to a lot of villages and meet with elderly people, primarily Alaska Natives.
Mm-hmm.
I was responsible for Yakutat, I went to Angoon and some of the other smaller villages and met a lot of the elders who at that time, of course, to go eat lunch at the senior center, by definition, you have to be a certain age. And I was really interested in learning their culture and learning the issues that were important to them. And I think that's really what sparked my interest first, was just focusing on the people that I met who were just so absolutely fascinating and were just so... just interesting, very interesting people. I mean, at that point in time, they'd seen a part of Alaska that we'll never see. Most people will never see.
Yeah.
And they'd grown up on subsistence and really living off the land and were just really interesting to talk to. And so that's really what got me interested in sort of end-of-life things, help because a lot of them, of course, when it came time for them, to transition, they would have to go from the villages to Anchorage or to Sitka or some other place. And so there was always that kind of transition, talking with them and their families because they couldn't stay. There were no facilities adequate to keep them in the villages.
And what did people do 50 years ago in the villages?
I think that they basically just died at home. They didn't go. I mean, I don't think they were ever sent away to facilities like they were back in the 80s when I started.
And we might find out this evening they may have had a better deal.
They may have.
They may very well have. I'll never forget. Right when I moved here, which is 32 years ago, I beat you by a year, I was in Sitka, and I was sitting on a dock in Sitka, and this very elderly couple was moving all their stuff into a boat, and I thought, it looked like they were moving, and the boat was what was their moving van. And I said, where are you going? And they said, we're going out to live on some remote island. And Sick has just gotten too big and busy for us. And I said, oh, but you'll be away from medical care. Because, you know, they're really old.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, yes, exactly.
That's the point.
That's one of the points.
Right.
So that they are not having intervention. Mm-hmm. And poignantly, that came up in my own family. My parents died fairly young, both at 63, and my dad had a stroke, and my mom called 911, and his life was saved. And his life was saved to be what people call a vegetable, and it produced great suffering. And my mother, who adored my father, but is a real frank person, said, I'm sorry I ever called 911.
Mm-hmm.
If he had just died then, but she saw my father suffering for so long in a state that he would not want to be in.
Well, and we went through that with my mother-in-law. Her husband, who passed away in June, had an end-of-life terminal illness and refused to go to a nursing home, refused to get hospice care, because he was of that generation where you don't ask the government for anything. Even though he was in the Korean War and he was in Germany, and you know, he certainly had sacrificed to get there and paid into Social Security and had Medicare, but the result for her was that it almost killed her too. She actually said when we got there that if he had lived for one more week, she thought he would have gone with her, because it was so taxing on her. And he was one of these, you know, Southern prideful men who wouldn't allow people to come in and really help, and so the entire burden of his care was on her.
So that's the other side.
That is
the
exactly.
other side.
Yeah.
And the other side is, it's very, very hard. There was a recent situation in the newspaper concerning physician-assisted suicide. As we know that it's now legal in three states in America, in Washington and in Oregon and in Montana.
Right.
And there was a 29-year-old woman this past year, young, beautiful, bright, just recently married, who was diagnosed in January with incurable brain cancer that was going to greatly foreshorten her life. They said, I think she had 6 months to live, and that her final months or weeks would be incredibly tortuous. And she thought about it and decided that she wanted to have physician-assisted end of life.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed there's a lot of euphemisms, because suicide, I think, is correct, but in our minds, I think we think of suicide as somebody who is depressed but able-bodied. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I'd like to almost use another term, but I've read hastening death as one term, and she went public with this. And it was all over the newspapers, beautiful young woman. So she was so articulate, and she was so upbeat. So her family moved to Oregon, and on November 1st, she had the physician, she used the pills that the physician had prescribed.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you have knowledge about this kind of thing. Could you tell us a little about it?
Well, I've actually looked at, I haven't looked at Montana's law, but I've looked at Washington's and Oregon's, and I think the Oregon actually is originally enacted was called the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, which you're looking for names, and it's throughout the statute. Which
a lot of people use that, and I think it's a lovely term.
Oh, I do too, and I think that at least as originally enacted and there have been regulations which have been promulgated to enact the law, it's a very, I think, a wonderful piece of legislation. And what it does essentially is And it's written, and you have to be an Oregon resident, but residency for purposes of the law is really pretty loosely defined.
Yeah, I understand it, you can just move there.
Yeah,
you have to be living in Oregon, yeah. Which means you have to have your physical body in Oregon.
You have to be there, you have to have an intent to remain, and there are all these indicia of residency.
Which is ironic if you're coming for...
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
But you can have, and as for example, and these aren't exclusive, but they are factors that are listed that are, any of these will work. You can have an Oregon driver's license, you can register to vote in Oregon. You don't have to ever have voted there. You can own property there or have a property interest, which means you could lease a property. You could go do a sublease. You could rent an apartment there. And I've actually researched this for folks I've worked with in the past.
Uh-huh. And so you have had clients who have considered this option.
Yeah, it's really interesting in Alaska. We have, in order to get health-related care, the vehicle that we have is called an Advanced Health Care Directive.
Yes.
There's essentially three primary documents that people who, when you're looking at estate planning or health planning, that you want to look at. Your power of attorney, which is for everything non-health that happens during life. That, like, if I were to designate you as my power of attorney, you could help me convey land on my behalf or bank for me or do anything other than health care.
Okay.
And you can do that for anyone. You can designate them as your attorney, in fact. An advanced health care directive does just health care. It's everything other than the financial part.
I've heard the term durable power of attorney. What does that mean?
That means that when you execute the power of attorney, that it survives your disability. That some people, actually, there's a box they check that says it ends when they're disabled, which I think is a horrible idea, because what's the point?
That's the
whole
right,
point of doing it.
Right, and these are your health care, your health care directives for the person who, usually if you're married, it's your spouse.
But not always.
But, and since my husband and I have executed, we've worked on these documents, what's really important is the next person.
Right.
Right.
Well, and I will say, those two documents are during life documents to help someone would help you make decisions about health care and non-health care. Then, of course, they die with you. And then the will that you've executed springs into life, ironically enough, when you die. It speaks at the date of death.
Yeah.
So these all are intertwined documents.
Uh-huh.
But in Alaska, the health care directive, there was it's a statutory form. It doesn't have to be exactly as written in the statute, but it has to substantially comply with it. And I actually printed it out today. It's interesting. It says you have the right to give instructions about your own health care to the extent allowed by law. And it's just in all these, it's always to the extent allowed by law. And, of course, in Alaska, it's illegal technically to kill yourself, or I say kill yourself, to take your own life, or it actually can be a criminal charge for someone to assist you with that.
Okay, so what about a failed suicide? So let's say somebody who's able-bodied, healthy, and of course they don't prosecute them for trying to kill themselves.
I'm not aware of any prosecution.
Okay.
But, it's on the books.
It's on the books.
And it could, so theoretically it could happen. So I've done a lot of work with terminally ill people, brain tumors, across the gamut with people who would apply for hospice and have been certified by their doctors to be within the last 6 months of their lives, because that's the trigger for Medicare coverage for hospice care at home. Mm-hmm. So people who are within that window, and of course none of us knows, the doctors don't know when they make that certification for sure, whether they're going to pass within that period. But people say, I don't want to stay in the condition that I'm in. I have a terminal illness. I know I have a terminal illness. I don't want to continue in this body, in this life, in this way. There's no hope. I am... it's just nothing's going to, it's only going to get worse. So what do I do? And I have advised people, of course, I can't tell them to do anything illegal.
Right.
But I said, well, if you're really looking at other viable options, there are these other states that have laws that will allow, under certain circumstances, folks to have a dignified death. And in my view, I haven't looked at the Montana law, so I don't really, that's a newer one. That was just passed.
Yeah.
I've looked at the Washington law, and I think the Oregon one, from where I sit, is really elegant and very, very well done. And we model our laws in Alaska on Oregon. I mean, when we became a state or a territory.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we took Oregon laws, and that was the model for our statutory provisions.
Oh,
so,
okay.
And I can see why. I mean, Oregon, this is a very well done statute. And the way it works is someone who is a resident, and again, I think that can be, at least as written in the statute, it's fairly loose. You have an attending physician, which certifies that you are has the primary responsibility for either being the patient's primary physician or someone that diagnoses the condition and looks at his or her medical records and makes a determination that that person is terminal, that there's no hope. And after the certification is made, there's a mandatory 15-day waiting period before another doctor called a consulting physician can dispense the medication that the person requests. And it's interesting, you can actually, in Oregon, you can make oral requests. It doesn't have to be written, but it has to be documented by both the attending physician and the consulting physician.
Can the attending physician be out of state?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think so. There's
nothing. They're just documenting that
right.
This is terminal.
I didn't see the. I think the consulting physician has to be an Oregon licensed doctor because he or she has to make. There's a reporting requirement.
Yeah. Well, they're writing the prescription.
Exactly. Well, no, the pharmacist is writing the prescription. It's actually they don't have the. Oh, they write the script, but they don't fill it.
Right. Yeah, right. They write the prescription.
Yeah. The pharmacist.
Right.
Yeah,
fills
but they're writing the script. And there's a provision that they can go if the either the attending physician or consulting physician believes that the person is depressed or has some sort of mental issue as opposed to a physical issue. There's a provision to refer that person to a psychiatrist or psychologist for further testing before his or her wishes can be further evaluated.
So they're trying to rule out people who are committing the kind of suicide we think of, which is because of despair.
Right.
But what an interesting thing, though. Look at how confounding that's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you've just gotten a diagnosis of Parkinson's or ALS or some...
Or Hodgkin's.
You've got the worst kind, and your prognosis is horrible,
mm-hmm.
and you're feeling terrible. Like the young woman I mentioned who took her own life recently, there was descriptions of her seizures mm-hmm. and her headaches, and, you know, she was miserable.
Right.
So you go like, who wouldn't be depressed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would be confounding. But anyways, I think that was probably to assure people that it wouldn't be random individuals
mm-hmm.
who were trying to hurt themselves.
Well, and there's other safeguards in the Oregon statute. You have to have two witnesses, neither of whom can be the attending physician,
mm-hmm.
neither of whom can be either a person who would benefit essentially by your demise, like a family member or someone who could take through your estate,
mm-hmm.
or if you're in a nursing home. The folks who have a financial interest in the nursing home, they can't be a witness because there's certain safeguards
for who can be
the witnesses to the written request that you want to have a dignified, that you want basically a prescription to end your life.
And you know, and polls that I've read show that Americans at least are the majority want Oregon laws. They want that
mm-hmm.
option.
Well, you think about it. I mean, I've actually given this quite a bit of thought because, you know, when you talk to people who, in the moment, who really need this service and have come to the place where they've made a rational decision based on their situation,
mm-hmm.
and you think, what kind of humane society, I mean, what kind of society do we have that would deny people the right, to determine their future under these circumstances? And
right.
I'm not talking about going out and, you know, promoting Sarah Palin's death panels. I'm talking about people who are going to die and have been certified to be terminally ill and to, you know, will die within 6 months in the doctor's medical judgment. And there's an objective basis for, you know, that person to want to take his or her life in certain circumstances.
And speaking of the misinformation about so-called death panels by Sarah Palin, she did us all a great disservice because what was going to go on in the Obamacare was to pay physicians
right.
to meet with patients to talk openly about, to take the time
mm-hmm.
to do exactly what enlightened medical people want, which is, these are your options. What do you want? We're going to talk in a minute about, there's an amazing book that I just got a hold of by Atul Gawande. He's a Harvard medical professor, he writes for The New Yorker. He's one of these brilliant doctors who is both a great writer, like Oliver Sacks, and
mm-hmm.
and a compassionate human being. And he just wrote a book that really addresses American medicine needs to change so that those dialogues occur, and people can see start thinking of more than just survival. Right. It's quality of life.
Well, and you know, you think about some analogies. What makes me hopeful that things can change in a relatively short period of time is look at the attitudes of the younger generation toward gay marriage. And, you know, how fast that attitude has changed in our country in, I mean, a really relatively short period of time.
Yeah.
And as people realize, and particularly if you're of the younger generation, you know, my children are, 25, soon to be 21 and 19. If they really sit down and analyze the percentage of our resources that are going to keeping people alive.
Yes.
Who objectively have no business being kept alive. And I don't mean that in a negative way.
No, I get it.
But you throw hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to keep people who don't want to be kept alive. For reasons that are beyond me. And, you know, there's only so many resources to go around for all the generations.
Right.
And, you know, you've got to think about it from a kind of a macro point of view, it seems to me, and say,
yeah.
Oh, gee, do we, now they don't want it. Why do we do this? Why do we take these heroic measures to keep people alive who don't want to be kept alive?
Right.
I mean,
right.
You know, what's the point except other than to feed the. The healthcare.
Well, don't you
the
think people, with the legalization of physician-assisted end of life, terminal illness, hastening of death, people were worried that everybody's going to do it. And I looked it up. What's happened in Oregon? And since the law changed in 1977. Is that correct? That sounds wrong. I think
no. It's actually 1994. There was a ballot initiative, and then there was a
statute. Yeah, I don't know where I got that.
97.
Okay, 97.
Yeah,
okay, so
97.
The statute changed in 97. Since then, 752 people have taken their own lives under the law, which is 0.2% of all Oregon deaths during that period. And I checked out. Europe is mixed in terms of that. I thought they would be a little ahead of us, but Netherlands passed a law for voluntary, they call it voluntary euthanasia, legal since 2001. And it does not exclude people with mental illness. It gives them the same rights, but they have to be terminal. If they're mentally ill and have a terminal illness that will cause them pain and suffering, they have the right to end it, just like people who are not mentally ill, which is a very different way of looking at it.
It is.
It's really disability rights. You know, why should I, because I have, somebody says they have a history of bipolar, why shouldn't they have the right?
But that, as I understand what you said, that can't be the sole basis for...
No, okay. It means if you have a terminal illness and you also have a history of mental illness. Mm-hmm. See, in Oregon, that could knock you out of the...
Well, you have the conferral provision. You know,
you do have the referral provision.
If your attending physician that determines that, and I think, frankly, from a potential legal liability point of view, if I were a doctor in that position... And there was any possibility that someone had a documented mental disability that his or her relatives later could claim was the primary reason.
Scare
that,
you off.
Yeah, exactly.
So because until we get, tort reform, we're not going to be,
You know, just for protection, I think I would go that extra step and make that referral, because then you have someone else that you can say, well, no, we referred that person to a psychiatrist who said, no, that's not the primary
reason.
And
it's fear, pain and
suffering. So he or she's depressed. You might be depressed, too, if you were in his or her physical condition.
Right.
You know?
Also, then following the Netherlands law, it became legal in Luxembourg, Belgium, and Switzerland is interesting. They have nothing on the books about any of it. And so Switzerland has become, they call it, what is it, death tourism. Germany, it's illegal, and France is too. France is just going to, it's about to have a referendum or something like that. They're about to take a vote on it. But so people from Germany go to Switzerland.
Do you know if that's a statutory prohibition in Germany and France, or is there a decision that just says under the French or German constitutions? Or?
Don't know.
Okay. That'd be interesting to know that.
I don't know. I didn't look at it with a legal eye.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, I just was curious to know the basis for the prohibition. It'd be interesting to know that.
Okay. We're going to take a little musical break here.
A little lighthearted.
a little lighthearted break. And the Kramers, John and Dolly, have picked out some. I'm going to blame them for whatever music if it's bad. No.
They picked out some music. Good. Thank you.
They picked out some music for us, and we will be right back to talk to continue our conversation about end-of-life preparations and care. Is Vance Sanders, a board member of the foundation, a former board member of the Foundation for the End of Life Care, as well as a Juno attorney. And we're discussing physician-assisted suicide in the first half of the show. And this part of the show, I'd like to talk about the idea of a good death and how we can prepare both psychologically and legally, best prepare for our own death. And I came upon a really interesting book that was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize by Marilyn Webb, and it's called The Good Death. And it has it really takes a look at the problem that modern medicine can actually create more suffering for people who are dying. And she writes, "The modern way of dying involves excessive emphasis on exotic technology and too little reliance on palliative care." So you and I, Vance, we need to talk about palliative care. Mm-hmm. We need to talk about hospice as alternatives, so that people do not feel that they're going to be, we're going to be, you know, flown down to Seattle and we'll be at Swedish hospital and we're totally out of control. Mm-hmm. That isn't the case, hopefully. Another very interesting book by the author I mentioned earlier, the Harvard professor and surgeon, Atul Gawande. He writes, "The medicalization of mortality becomes most apparent at the very end of life, when the American health system spends billions of dollars, as you said, on what he calls it the medical equivalent of lottery tickets, aggressive and often futile interventions that make patients miserable and keep them apart from loved ones because they're in the hospital." And I have had more than one friend or family member, I've had a number, who are faced with, should I do the stem cell transplant? Should I do this? Should I do that? When they have a terminal illness but it might increase their longevity by 6 months. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, just that decision, you almost wish they didn't have to make the decision, because, you know, to have the option, because those last 6 months could be hell, or they could be fine. Mm-hmm. They could see their kids' graduation, or they could be vomiting. They could be in the hospital.
Right.
It's really tough.
You know, though, having represented over the years many people who are in that situation,
yeah,
who are within the last bit of their life and have a terminal illness, and a documented there's been a certification by a physician that he or she has 6 months or left to live,
yeah,
which is,
yeah,
the trigger for hospice. It's rare that I have talked to anybody in that situation who wants to extend their life. What they want to do in that period is to be in a place where people they love are around them. And there's just some really wonderful things that can be done, like family stories, journaling with family members.
Yes.
And talking to people, being taped. I've done that with several people. They
want histories?
They want their family histories. They want those to be preserved, but, you know, because this is their life, and, you know, who's coming after this, grandchildren or great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
They want there to be the future generations to know who they were, and,
yes,
and not to be in some hospital hooked up to incredible machines getting, you know, this treatment and that experimental treatment, and being so weak when they come back from those treatments that there's no quality of life at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, the connection with the family is, I think, really, really, really important. And what we've done in some villages back when we had the old cassette recorders, mm-hmm, had people talk about their lives and then give that to the family member and say, you know, this is from your grandmother, your grandfather, your aunt, or your uncle, and this was really important to them.
Yes. When you say we, are you saying the end of life?
No, I wasn't involved with end of life at that point. That was something that was, I did that in a few cases, not so many back then.
Oh, you mean you were their lawyer?
Yeah, but as time has gone by, and, you know, actually you can, I think that can be a really valuable thing, not only to the person, and like I said, but to the family. And you have a real record, you know, a family record. Of course, back then, you know, it's a cassette, but now you could videotape it. It could be on, you know, you could digitize it. I mean, there's really a lot of options now technologically that weren't available then.
What I would give to have that from my own parents.
Well, think about
who
that.
Who died 35, well, it's too late, you know, died 35 years ago, because then I had children after they died.
Right.
And how I would love to share their voice, mm-hmm, share their personality. Oh, my gosh.
You know, and it's interesting, we were talking a bit earlier about your family, about your,
yeah,
situation. It's one thing to talk to clients about this who I have a professional detachment from. I mean, I'm close to my clients,
yeah,
but there's that, you know, you're trying to give them advice that's not influenced by emotion, you know, like a certain base of emotion. Going through this with my family now, I will tell you, it is much different. There's a much different dynamic as a son talking to my father or my stepmother or my mother-in-law than there is a client, because there's a layer there. You're trying to talk about these things, and it's like, well, why do you think I'm going to die soon? Well, no, but I just would like for my children to know what it was like when you were a boy, you know, growing up on the farm. I mean, that's the kind of thing mm-hmm. we talk about at Christmas every now and then, but I would like for them to have, you know, your recollections of that. And I just think it would be interesting to do. But it's hard to broach that because there's some recognition that their lives are, you know, in the twilight zone.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is not so easy to do when it's your own family member.
Well, or when the family members, now you can get me to do it, okay, because
yeah.
I'm kind of like right there, but that's kind of my work and my profession. It is. There'll be people who, you know, the joke about this like 98-year-old woman who was told she was terminal and she raised her fist and said, "Why me, oh Lord?" You know, like it's never going to happen.
Right. But that, back to something we were talking about earlier, the advance directive.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's really important in the advance directive to lay out what you want to happen. That you don't, you know, that you really, while you have the capacity to do it, and there's in the at least in section one of the statutory form, there's a provision that talks about other, and you can mm-hmm. attach additional pages.
Oh yeah.
I always advise people to give as much detail as
yes.
they want to give, and I really mean that. I mean, it can be 6 or 8 pages. You know, here's what I want. I don't want to go to a hospital. I don't want to have chemotherapy if this or this
yeah.
happens.
Yeah.
I don't want to have food. I don't want to have water. Whatever they want, and be really specific. And because of my experience dealing with family members, a lot of times when you have siblings, one wants to have mom or dad to be subject to heroic measures.
Yes.
And one maybe not. And then you have the conflict in the family, and the parent who, at the worst possible time of his or her life, is playing peacemaker with the children about his or her care.
Yes.
So to the extent that it's written down and you feel that you've articulated what you want to happen, and it might be a good idea not to have one of those siblings make that mm-hmm. decision for you, but to have a good friend who knows what you want and says, "Look, I'm designated by your mother to carry out her wishes, and that's exactly what's going to happen."
And so you want to designate somebody.
Oh, absolutely.
You want to designate somebody, I think, who is assertive.
Exactly.
And who does not get overly intimidated by physicians.
Yeah.
Who can say, "Nope. This is what we're going to do." Because the whole push of our medical system is to keep people alive.
Right.
And that's so you almost have to push against it
exactly.
at times.
Yeah.
Unless you've got an unusual hospital that has palliative care, that has specialists in geriatric mm-hmm. medicine that really understand that.
Well, we're very fortunate in Juneau because we do have physicians that are – Dr. Urata is wonderful in that regard. But, you know, it's a smaller community. You know, he would know his patients for many years and follow them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always, you know, some communities are more transitory.
Yes.
And I find that the native communities, it's sometimes not easy to find someone who's assertive and will stand
yeah.
up to the medical establishment. So I counsel people, look, you know, do you have a good friend who, you know, meets these criteria, you know, who can talk to authority and stand up to authority and say, "I'm advocating on behalf of my good friend.
And I've got the legal right to do
exactly.
so."
Exactly. I've got the legal right to do so. And, you can think what you want to think medically, but this says what it says, and this is what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, because that's not always easy to communicate to.
Yeah. Well, I was reading about the advanced medical directives, and it turns out that half of all Americans said they were counting on friends and family members to carry out their wishes about how they wanted to die. But 75% said they had never spelled out those wishes to anyone. And a significant subset of that percent, 75%, had probably never, this is the author said this, never articulated their wishes to themselves. We're in denial of death mm-hmm. in our culture big time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we really hide it. And just having like a high proportion of people, I think it's your example. I don't know if you said that to your dad, really. Like, I want to I want to record you. And he said, what do you think, I'm dying?
Well, it's more indirect than that. But
yeah,
that's
got
the message.
Got it.
But
well, yeah.
I got the message.
You got the message. We don't want to go there. And as having worked in hospice with clients, I realized you don't go any further than where the client is at.
Right.
Because if they think they're going to live forever.
But, you know, it's amazing that statistic that you read. How many people don't know that really they do drive the train? And this is their body and their life that we're talking about. And the more specific and you know, clear they can be,
yeah,
in an advanced directive, even though the three or four lines that are this section are woefully insufficient for
totally
doing that, just incorporate by reference the pages that
you want to
add.
That's what we did. We added pages. My husband and I added pages, and I added dementia page because
that's a great idea.
Yeah, because an individual can live with dementia and very late stage dementia for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it may sound pretty radical, but I said, if I can't feed myself, I do not want, not just intravenous feeding, I don't want anybody to spoon feed me.
Mm-hmm.
And now I remember I have to mention liquid,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, liquid's really important because I actually had a case where that was an issue where the person who was dying, the doctor, I met with him and the doctor and another family member, and the doctor advised that you can withhold food and last for a long time. Hydration, the death is much more certain and much sooner, like a week to 8 days. If you don't drink, that's the key, actually.
And you can still keep the person comfortable.
Yes, yes. And I'm talking about in a palliative care, end
right,
of life
right
situation where they weren't in Oregon, they were in Alaska, and that was...
So legally, like if you're in a hospital and you're in Alaska and you have written in your advanced directive, mm-hmm, medical directives, that under these circumstances, I don't want to be fed or given liquid, then does that hold? That's not considered assisted suicide.
No. It's actually the statutory definition is if I'm unable to safely take nutrition fluids, check the ones. It says, in accordance with my choices and 6B above, I do not wish to receive artificial nutrition and hydration.
And you better put with a spoon,
yeah,
or with a straw.
And other instructions, that's where you would clarify
that
above.
It.
And this is, I mean, this is a statutory form.
Got it.
In fact, if a healthcare professional didn't follow this, the representative of the person, you know, who executed the advance directive would have the authority to sue the person, to compel the person to honor this.
Oh, okay. So it's a legal document.
Oh, yeah.
And the physician has to honor it.
Exactly.
I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mentioned Dr. Atul Gawande. The name of his book is Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. And he talks about how in 1945 most deaths in the United States took place at home, but by the 80s, 70%, only 70% of people died at home. Mm-hmm. So he, you know, talks about this increasing medicalization. And he writes, first, in medicine and society, we have failed to recognize that people have priorities, that they need us to serve besides just living longer. Second, the best way to learn those priorities is to ask about them. And he goes on to write, I've also discovered that the discussions most successful clinicians had with their patients involved just a few important questions that often unlocked transformative possibilities. Number one, what is their understanding of their health or condition? Number two, what are their goals if their health worsens? And number three, what are their fears? And number four, what are the trade-offs they are willing to make and not willing to make?
Mm-hmm.
So this is that talk that
exactly
you want a physician who will have that kind of talk. And the other thing he found that, and this isn't end of life, this is around people who, the elderly, people who would need some support in living, that there's been, he talked about some transformations in nursing homes and other senior communities, that what makes the elderly, and meaning all of us will be elderly if we're lucky to live to be elderly, happy is to feel self-efficacy, mm-hmm. to be autonomous. And when you go into a sterile nursing home environment, you are in, you lose any ability to make decisions. Everything is decided for you. And so there's now a movement to, you know, add pets. I think the Pioneer Home has pets, don't they?
Well, Flower Court allows pets, sure.
Oh, they allow pets.
Oh, yeah.
So things that people can take care of to mm-hmm. give them some meaning in life, a sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right on. I mean, I think that that's very important to allow people to be the captain of their end-of-life ship. And you know, and there's the vehicle. I keep coming back to the advance directive, and it, you know, it's just a piece of paper, but it's so much more than that. And if people took the time to really think through what they want to happen, different scenarios. You were talking about dementia. I mean, dementia can go on, as you know, for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have something in advance directive that says, if I have dementia, mm-hmm. you know, as certified by my doctor, if
right.
I have dementia.
Right.
Here's what I don't want to happen.
And that means somebody, you don't have to move to Portland. That means that people my age, okay, in their 60s or 70s, what they the greatest fear is getting dementia
mm-hmm.
and being incapacitated. And so what we're really saying is you don't have to move to Portland. You
mm-hmm.
can have restrictions on liquid and food in your advance directives
mm-hmm.
if you so wish. Well, it comes down to some hard decisions for some patients about
mm-hmm.
when they do get the opportunity to have some risky, possible, possible prolonging, life prolonging for a few months. I know my friends and family members who I think of who have been in that situation, it's trading off the possibility of having 3 more months or 6 more months to the possibility of having 3 or 6 months, good months versus miserable months.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tough one.
It
and
is.
We need the time to be able to sit down and talk about it. And often that is neglected and certainly isn't paid for by health insurance, which is what the Affordable Care Act wanted to do.
You know, that you mentioned that provision earlier in the context of the Palin death panel quip. That didn't. My understanding is that did not make it into Obamacare.
It didn't. That's my impression. I'm not 100% sure, but my impression is it didn't make it in, and that she was instrumental.
You know, I still think, though, there's a way for that to happen. I think if your treating physician were to refer, say you're Medicare eligible, for example,
uh-huh.
and your treating physician says, I think counseling is really important and has some basis for that in the chart note,
mm-hmm.
so it would be covered by Medicare, because that, you know, in my experience, that's usually the driver for what a person does or doesn't want in terms of, you know, access to health care at the end of the day is it covered? Do I have to saddle my family with this, or is it covered by Medicare or Medicaid or some other provider?
Right.
And so if you go to your treating physician and ask that person to make the referral, it may be covered by, for example, Medicare.
Counseling isn't. Counseling by you could not get counseling in Juneau.
None at
covered.
All.
Nobody in private practice.
What if it were called something different than counseling? I don't know that it could be covered.
No.
It's provider specific.
No, psychotherapy.
Not
private,
covered by Medicare.
Nobody in private practice in Juneau can accept Medicare for psychotherapy. Now, maybe some places, mental health hospitals,
okay.
inpatient treatment.
So that probably wouldn't work here.
So it doesn't work. And I think also you really need to talk to the person who knows your medical condition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to feel like you're getting the scoop. I did want to, before we wind up, and we do have a few minutes, I wanted to see what you thought about this, Vance. I mentioned the book The Good Death by Marilyn Webb.
Right.
And you know, everybody wants a good death. And actually what most people want is they want to die in their sleep. They don't want to go through any of this. Okay, they just want to die in their sleep. But other people want to have notice, and they want to be able to, you know, finish up business and
mm-hmm.
say, make amends. So here's what Marilyn Webb talks about the good death. Common factors that good deaths have. Open, ongoing communication with doctors, patients, and families. 2, preservation of the patient's decision-making powers for as long as possible. Sophisticated pain control. And you do medical law, so you're probably aware of the narcotics laws.
Mm-hmm.
And have you come upon any problems with any of your patients where a physician is afraid with any of your clients of addiction for painkillers?
I have, and the way that's generally dealt with is to have a pain management contract, because, and I think a lot of times that's physician driven again, because that it is so tightly regulated, the narcotics part of the practice. Judo, though, I have found to be incredibly, the doctors here that I deal with a lot are really, they really focus on the patients, at least the ones I've dealt with.
We're lucky.
It's not, we're very, very lucky.
We're
in
lucky.
That regard.
And also, it's a small community, so
right.
You could even find out if a person was doctor shopping for pain medication.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But if there's someone who genuinely, you know, is in
yeah.
need, I just think we're fortunate to have the kind of community where we have caring doctors who recognize that. And the way they deal with it, I think, is the contract. I forget the technical term for it, but
mm-hmm.
it's a narcotics
yeah.
contract. You probably know better than I the name of it, but it's you have an agreement with your patient about how much, you know,
because I don't prescribe.
No,
but
prescribing
physician.
Doctors over what
yeah.
period of time, how much is prescribed, and that they won't seek other, you know, medications from other doctors. There'll be the exclusive source and some of those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then she goes on, item 4, limits on excessive treatment, excessive medical interventions. Then 5, focus on preserving the patient's quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
That makes complete sense, mm-hmm. because it's really looking, I think we just all intuitively are looking at that, and we want to have a medical provider who doesn't just look at medical survival rates, mm-hmm. but looks at the quality of the time. And I think you're right in Juno. I really mm-hmm. feel we probably, it just feels like you're more likely to get a physician mm-hmm. who will consider that, first of all, we are not as managed care as most other places.
Right.
You're not going to group health.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean if you go to a managed care facility that you would get impersonal care, but you might not get the same doctor all the time.
Well, there's another factor I would add in Alaska to that, and that is preservation of, I wouldn't say family wealth, but here, if you want to get a long-term care, for example, in Alaska, in Southeast Alaska, you're looking at an average of $20,000 to $22,000 a month. You add that up for a while. You know, a year, you're at $250,000.
Wow.
I mean, it doesn't take long to blow through, you know, a family nest egg. So what do most people do? They qualify for Medicaid, which means that, you know, they either spend down over time everything they've built up in a lifetime to qualify for Medicaid, or have other strategies that can, you know, hopefully eventually qualify them for that. And that's a factor that's not, I mean, that's Alaska. I mean, that to me, that's a factor in Alaska that's not really dealt with in any of the literature, because just the cost of the care. You know, we don't have continuing care communities in Alaska like they do in a lower 48.
Oh, yes.
You know,
we
Where someone goes in at the equivalent of a level 1 in a Pioneers
yes.
home
mm-hmm.
and then progresses to level 2 and may mm-hmm. fall and break a hip and go to level 3
mm-hmm.
or live independently and then live, you know, just progress to higher levels of care. So, I mean, you've got Pioneers home. You've got Juno has... a couple of smaller assisted living
yes,
homes? We used
I
to have
so.
Many, but now virtually no assisted living homes here. We have Wildflower Court, which I think is a wonderful institution, a Pioneers home.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, at-home care, which Medicare doesn't cover unless you're within the last 6 months, hospice care. So there's that factor, too, is the cost of care here.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're retired and you chose the gold plan, that will help, but it won't pay completely for a nursing home.
And there's a lot
home.
Of exclusions, too.
Oh, yeah. So that's another cost of, you know, you talk about heroic medical care. I mean, you have to factor that in, too, about what, you know, if you have to go to, say, a nursing home as opposed to staying at home, that's a real cost.
I read an interesting article. You may have heard of Susan Sontag. She's a public intellectual who died of a kind of blood cancer. And her son wrote... I read an article that was based on the book. I think I read it in the New Yorker. And she spent, I think, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center for heroic measures mm-hmm. that made her miserable and broke the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote, it inspired him to talk about how this shouldn't be. And, you know, really, if we're looking at what's good for all of us, I mean, what brings ultimate happiness,
mm-hmm.
it's not trying to, it's not quantity over quality,
mm-hmm.
whether we're talking about our anything in our life.
Yeah.
So, and people know that. They say, I want quality of life.
Exactly.
What will this give me?
Well, very few people, I mean, you've had clients who, patients who are, you know, in this situation, end of life. How many of them want to go spend the last 4 or 5 months of their life at sitting at Harborview, you know, getting infusions every day, being sicker than a dog, not being able to be in Juneau and enjoy family and friends? How many? I mean, not many that
not
I've
many.
Talked to.
No.
If
no.
they have a choice. So, I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah. I have a question for you, Vance. Because of all that you've seen in your work experience with families and people who have had terminal illnesses and just people who haven't, just older people,
mm-hmm.
people who aren't going to live forever, how has that affected your own thoughts and actions, both with your own family and, like, would you have your kids write an advanced care directive? You know, they're only, I mean, adult kids, like once
yeah.
they're 25 or something.
Absolutely. Yeah, my daughter Molly did when she was in high school. Sarah Hannon's class, her history class, had them do an advanced directive and I think a power of attorney, if I remember correctly, which I thought was a wonderful thing to do.
Really?
You know, it's affected me. I've had some, over the years, many clients who I've gone really close to, and then I've lost them because just the type of law I practice. And it always really saddens me. But what I think we really do need to go where Oregon has gone, frankly. I mean, I think, and my, you know, I come from generations of ministers. I mean, my dad's a retired Southern Baptist minister, and he probably wouldn't agree with me on this. But the, you know, to me, the essence of love and kindness is not keeping you alive at the end of the day. It's treating you with dignity and respect when you are at the point where, you know, you're terminal. I mean, and that's the way we should be treating people, it seems to me. And, you know, we spend in this state, you know, we send children out of state. We keep them in foster care. We send them to facilities down in Colorado because we can't adequately treat them here. You know, we do all this stuff. We pay nursing homes $20,000 to $22,000. We don't pay it all with state dollars, but state and federal dollars for people to live there. Let's, you know, be a little creative here and come up with a Death with Dignity Act that allows Alaskans, you know, by the way, there's a specific right to privacy here, Article 1, Section 22 of our Constitution. Let's allow people here to have a dignified death under certain narrow circumstances. I'm not advocating
like
for the mass
Oregon
exchange.
Law.
Exactly.
Like the
That's
Oregon law.
It's a wonderful
law.
Model. I mean, we, you know, we're bigger than we are right now, you know.
It's going to take, yeah. Now, this is interesting. I wonder how the referendum, how what kind of groups got it on the Washington State, the Montana State, and the Oregon State referendum. Because of all places, Alaska is really into individual rights.
Oh, I know.
And this obviously trumps, you know, you could stereotype Christianity as saying mm-hmm. no to this.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of people...
You know, when we started the show, though, you talked about how difficult a time people have talking about death. And when you're talking about a ballot initiative or a referendum that is death-related, it's tough to talk about. But, I mean, it's inevitable. None of us is going to get out of here alive. I mean, it just isn't going to happen. Let's talk about something that really is inevitable and, you know, come up with a way to make it work for all of us.
Sounds good. And just perfect timing, Vance. We don't get out of this alive. I want to thank Vance Sanders for coming to the K2 studio tonight.
It's great to be
and
back.
For his, thank you, Vance, and for his compassionate insights on end-of-life issues. Thanks also to John Kramers and Dolly Kramers, who have shown up once a month and seamlessly worked together on the technical side of this program. So tune in February next month for another outrageous program on a topic that few people dare to speak. See you next month. Good night.
Thank you, Elaine.